The main focus of what I do professionally is working on volcanoes. And that primarily involves working with the kinds of hazardous processes that occur on volcanoes involving water. Rather than the stuff that builds the volcanoes, I study the stuff that tears them down. Floods and landslides and mud flows and things like that. And in case you're wondering, I'm not a theologian. But anyway, I guess we can start the tape now.
Tom, before you do that, may I interrupt?
Sure.
I am speaking for a group, and we feel that you have shown so much love toward us and your willingness to spend time with us to explain God's creation, namely on taking us on a geological hike. And as a token of our love and appreciation, we have something for you. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Whew, I don't know if that's a hard way or an easy way to start. Okay, let's start now, I guess. This is the session on God, creation, and science. And I guess, first of all, I should say that I do this with some trepidation because I'm not a theologian. But this is an area that I am a scientist, and this is an area that's just long fascinated me and given me lots to think about over the years. And I guess I was encouraged to tackle the topic when I read what this summer's theme was in listening to the sacred, and how we all grow and are blessed by interaction with each other, where we are open and share our ideas in honesty and with respect, and I'm hoping that we can do that here this evening. I definitely want this to be a discussion. This is not something I'm an expert on by any means, and so I perhaps can give some background on the scientific point of view if some of you have questions on that. But I'd like to kind of keep this out in front of us as something we can do some give and take with as we go along, and just sort of hear what everybody feels. I probably should start in the beginning by giving you where I'm coming from, and that is that I do believe in God. I know in my heart that God has been working in my life for some time now, and I have been extremely blessed by Him in many ways, and my faith is pretty solid. On the other hand, I am a scientist, and I believe that God gives us brains and that we're supposed to use them to the best of our ability. So I guess just to start things out, I'll state the obvious, and that is that in many quarters, it's believed that God and the concept of God's creation can't somehow coexist with the scientific side of things, that somehow God and science have to be in conflict with each other. Maybe you've heard these little sayings that it's either the age of rocks or the rock of ages, or how heaven goes or how to go to heaven. Basically, some people view it as a dichotomy that is impossible to really balance. But I guess I would throw out right from the beginning, do these two seemingly opposite points of view have to be in conflict or contradiction with each other? Or is it possible that maybe we're talking about two separate but parallel ways of looking at the world? And with that, I'd like to just kind of throw it open to to some of your thoughts and where you folks are coming from. Has it been a struggle for you, or has it been an easy thing to rationalize and justify in your own minds the seeming conflict between God and science? I don't want to make anybody feel hesitant about speaking out if you really do feel that they are two things that are separate and can't be put together, really.
Tom?
Yeah.
I'll kick it off if nobody else wants to. I sometimes find myself getting really excited. I have never been trained in science, and I am now a pastor. But I found myself getting really excited by, especially by some of the astronomy kinds of things. You know, like when there was a big story last spring sometime about the Big Bang Theory. And I've been interested in that for a long time, and then black holes, and I mean, all this just seems so wondrous to me. And you know, I don't understand it all, and as I said, I have no real scientific training in that. But finding myself getting so excited by that, and the idea that you know, we might be able, you know, are we going to find the edge of the universe, or what does this mean? That it just seems to me our ideas about God as human beings are so small a lot of times. I mean, that we have these real boundaries. And I remember trying to preach a sermon on this after the story had come out, whenever it was in the last 6 months, and, you know, saying that it isn't, that to me it expands my idea of God in a way, some of these scientific discoveries, rather than finding a coming in conflict. And shouldn't we be able to be challenged by this, that if somehow our God is finite, is that really God? You know, I mean, if God couldn't have done this, or you know, I don't find them in conflict, but I find in the way science can both inspire awe in me and can challenge my thinking about our Creator.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I find the challenge of getting into the mind of a person who would not want to question what goes on around them as far as nature and so forth. And my struggle is what kind of a mindset does a person have? I can't imagine not being able to question how the earth came into being and all these, the deep questions that I think geology and physics has to offer. But yet I know that there are some very fundamental schools that have science and they teach it. I'm still trying to reconcile in my mind how they can question the how and the why together. I mean, how do they do it and separate them? And I guess what I'm saying in so many words, how do I get inside the mindset of a person who says, let's not question nature, this is the way God wants it, without leading a completely boring life?
Well, there.
What do they think?
I don't hold that viewpoint, so I can't say. But I have met some very sincere and very capable, intelligent people who have very strong beliefs that. That the creation story in the Bible is the literal truth, and that somehow science has to be explained in a way that supports that.
You know, scientists like that? Do you have friends in the scientific
community? I have met intelligent, capable people with PhDs who do believe that, yes.
Geologists?
Well, I met a meteorologist once, and that's an earth scientist. That's pretty close.
Have you ever heard anyone speak from the Creation Institute in El Cajon, California?
I have not, no.
They can explain they're still studying so much, but they study continually, trying to put the two together. And I've heard one of the scientists speak, and by the time he finishes, it sounds pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is material out, put out by them, and they're continually working on different little theories down there.
Mm-hmm.
They have a museum that's open to public.
I think the approach is, from what I have read, is to basically to look at the theories that generally hold sway today in science and to look at ways in which there might be holes in those theories. And, you know, any theory is just that. We, as scientists, we really don't deal in facts per se. It's usually theories. Well, a theory being a way of explaining something using measurable, quote, facts. But the theory itself, even if widely accepted, is still just a theory, and there's always room for trying to disprove it. And in fact, that is really the way science works. If a theory always has to be tested, and you test them by trying to disprove them. And so ultimately, that's good for science, and good for our understanding of how things work.
Is the model a matter of time concept? If you think of evolution, you automatically think of a many, many, a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think of creation, there's a tendency, I think, to think that it happened now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to bring those two together, that we can accept the fact that creation could have happened over many, many billions of years. Many billions of years.
That's right. Most scientists believe that on the basis of dating of rocks that's done using a technique called radiometric dating, and that's using radioactive elements that are found in all rocks, that the Earth is approximately 4.7 billion years old, and that life on Earth began somewhere a little less than a billion years ago, probably, and really blossomed into an incredible variety and diversity of forms about 600 million years ago. On the other side of the coin, I think it was Bishop Usher tried to calculate the age of the Earth using all the genealogies in the Bible and concluded that the Earth began, I think it was 4004 BC, wasn't that the date he came up with? Which clearly is incompatible with the kinds of numbers that we get from radiometric dating. Now, clearly the Earth is very, very old. These questions really raised havoc in the mid-19th century when geology really first arrived on the scene as a science. And although the geologists then didn't have these radiometric dating techniques to assign precise ages to rocks, still they started seeing these tremendous sequences of thick strata full of different fossils, and they could see over these expanses of strata that fossils changed and life forms evolved and changed. And even then, they were struck by how much time would have to be required for all this to happen, for these kinds of changes to occur. And so even before they could prove it, they were thinking that the Earth has to be a lot older than 4,000 years B.C. Yeah?
I think a lot of the heat and light that's been generated by this let's say, juxtaposition of science and theology in particular,
mm-hmm.
first of all, it isn't that there are two fields which are head-to-head. In fact, they're about entirely different things. In particular, the Bible is not a book of scientific theories. it's a revelation, and it is imprecise, and it was never intended to have exact numbers and things that scientists need. So it's I think somewhat unfair to look into the Bible to find the basis for scientific theories. And in the same way, it's not useful to expect scientists to come up with theories that fit our particular theology.
Mm-hmm.
I think a good example is the account of the virgin birth, which, of course, biologists would have a difficult time explaining. Well, the church has treated this over 3 years in a particular way, and that's to call it a mystery. The emphasis there is that we have two things that appear to be in conflict. What is wrong here is not one or the other necessarily, but our understanding.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. Thank you. One of the things that came to me fairly early on is that science and theology really are addressing two different questions. In a very simplified way, scientists are asking the question how, and theologians are asking the question why. And I really agree with what you said, that they don't have to be butting heads on that. One of the things I wanted to do this evening was to contrast an interesting juxtaposition of the creation story as it is in Genesis, and just sort of a scientist creation story, so to speak, that just happened to be, these are just passages that I extracted in some introductory material in this textbook that I brought along, The Dynamic Earth, Introduction to Physical Geology. It's one I brought just as a reference for myself for these 2 weeks, and it's also one of the most popular college-level texts in geology right now. And I was just comparing the creation story with what was written in here, and found that there, you know, was really some amazing parallels. So, if I can find my spot. Okay, so what I thought we might do just for fun here, I'll ask Kevin to read sort of section by section, and he'll do one, and then I'll just do one, and we'll just kind of compare as we go along. I want to start with number one.
Okay. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters.
The birth throes of our sun and its planets were similar to those of many other suns. Birth began with space that was not entirely empty. Space was not empty because an earlier star had exploded in what astronomers call a supernova. The explosion scattered atoms of various elements everywhere throughout a huge volume of space. Most of the atoms were hydrogen and helium, but small percentages of all other chemical elements were present too. Even though thinly spread, the atoms formed a tenuous, turbulent, swirling cloud of cosmic gas.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day.
Over a very long period, the gas thickened as a result of a slow gathering of all the thinly spread atoms. The gathering force of the gas was gravity. And as the atoms slowly moved closer together, the gas became hotter and denser. Near the center of the gathering cloud of gas, hydrogen and helium atoms eventually became so tightly pressed and so hot that they began to fuse and form heavier elements. When, in the gas cloud that formed the solar system, fusion of hydrogen and helium commenced, the sun was born. The time is estimated to have been about 6 billion years ago.
And God said, "Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water." So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it. And it was so. God called the expanse sky, and there was evening and there was morning, the second day.
At some stage, the cool outer portions of the cosmic gas cloud became compacted enough to allow solid objects to condense, in the same way that ice condenses from the water vapor to form snow. The solid condensates eventually became the planets, moons, and other solid objects in the solar system.
And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear. And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good.
As the planet Earth grew larger and larger, the continual impacts of meteorites would necessarily have raised the temperature of the Earth. In addition, heat must continually have been added from another source. Among the many chemical elements of the Earth are several that are naturally radioactive. That is, they spontaneously transform to another element. Examples are uranium, thorium, and potassium, which transform to lead and argon, respectively. But every time a radioactive transformation occurs, a tiny amount of heat is also produced. Therefore, radioactivity continued to heat the Earth, even as the frequency of impacts declined. Eventually, the Earth began to melt. Lighter melted materials, rich in silicon, aluminum, and sodium, and potassium, rose toward the surface. Rocks at the Earth's surface are still rich in these elements. Denser melted materials, such as molten iron, sank to the center of the planet. The melting released volatile elements, and these escaped as gases through volcanoes. It was the escape gases, mainly water vapor, carbon dioxide, methane, and possibly ammonia, that gave rise to Earth's atmosphere. From the same source came the water we now find in the Earth's oceans.
Then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds. And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it, according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening and there was morning, the third day. And God said, let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea, and every living and moving thing with which the water teems, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number, and fill the water in the seas, and let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day.
The Phanerozoic eon is divided into the Paleozoic, old life, Mesozoic, middle life, and Cenozoic, recent life eras. Each name reflecting the relative stage of development of the life of these intervals. Paleozoic forms of life progress from marine invertebrates to fishes, amphibians, and reptiles. Early land plants also appeared, expanded, and evolved. The Mesozoic era saw the rise of the dinosaurs, which became dominant vertebrates on land.
And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good.
Toward the end of that era, the Mesozoic era, mammals first appeared and later dominated the Cenozoic era. The Mesozoic era also witnessed the evolution of flowering plants, while during the Cenozoic era, grasses appeared and became an important food for grazing mammals.
Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them.
Man-like creatures first appeared about 4 million years ago. Thanks, Ken. Have any thoughts? I found it really interesting to do that when I was working this out. Well, there are some scientists who don't believe in God.
I'm sure.
Clearly. But on the other hand, you know, science in capital letters is not an enterprise that is designed to try to refute the Bible and religion on earth either, as some people feel it is. Some Christians feel that scientists are enemies of Christianity. And there may be some who have a cause or an axe to bear, but all the scientists I have ever run across are people who are just really interested in trying to figure out what the truth is as best they can determine. And it's not, it doesn't have a moral basis at all. It's just trying to understand what the evidence tells us. Yeah.
Well, there's a subtlety to this. Quite recently, Stephen Hawking was in both Seattle and Vancouver,
mm-hmm.
and sold out at the Opera House at $45 a ticket, which is amazing. And he is actually trying to reduce the intervention in his cosmology of God to a null question. You know? And he's got a huge cult following for that. Right? So science has moved now to trying to nullify, some scientists, not you, not me, to negating any interest in this, the why question we talked about earlier. It's just not important. I think that's more of a threat than, you know, Darwin, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I haven't heard him speak, and I haven't read his book. And he also sold out in Portland when he came. You know, and it may be that he's saying that, well, that's not a relevant question to the one we have before us, and that's trying to understand how the cosmos works. And he may or may not be interested in hearing what God has to say about it. Yeah.
Well, and you know, it seems to me that theology also seeks to address the who question. You know, who is behind it? Who is, you know, who is responsible for bringing what is into being? That kind of question. But to say a little different from what you and you two, Tom, said a little earlier, you know, it does seem to me that science and religion deal with different kinds of truth. You know, I have an undergraduate degree in science, but you know, science, to me, it seems to teach you to question a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
which, in my opinion, is good. I think that's an approach, you know, that you don't just accept things at face value, but that you ask questions of it.
Mm-hmm.
But to reduce it greatly, you know, I mean, science deals with the kind of question that, with the kind of truth, if you will, that says that if you take one atom of hydrogen and two of oxygen under the right conditions, you'll get water every time, whether it's in Minneapolis or Portland or Tokyo. But religion deals with the kind of question that asks, how can you prove to me that you love your spouse or that you love your parents? And it seems to me that is, to some degree, based upon our experience. You know, I can say, well, you know, I love my spouse in the same way that you love yours, or something to that effect. You know, rather than based upon the kind of duplicatable certainty that science is so dependent upon. And they're really not willing to say much of anything that can't be duplicated by another person. Mm-hmm. Even though the evidence may lean strongly in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Is there another hand I saw out of the corner of my eye here?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
What are your views on teaching creationism in the public schools? There's a very strong movement.
There is.
In fact, a district in California has just passed a resolution saying that they must now teach creationism in through their science courses.
And they're teaching it as a parallel but equal version next
sure.
to evolution?
I'm not sure if they take their place of evolution or they're teaching it. I'm not sure. I just remember that.
Well, I just have to give you my personal view on that, and that is that, like several have said here, they're two separate questions, and I don't think creationism per se should be there in science, in a science class where we're trying to just take the facts as the facts seem to be presenting themselves to us, and try to understand. Now, if a creationist's interpretation had evolved out of a scientific evaluation of the data, that would be a different thing, but it's come at it from a different angle, and that is from the faith of some and scripture and then trying to shoehorn it into science, and to me that just doesn't feel good.
It seems to me if you want that taught in the schools, you should expect the schools to teach religion, to have a course mm-hmm. in it, because I think you can object to that from a theological point of view. That's ripping something right out of the theological context and sticking it where it doesn't belong. How can you understand the whole rest of the business that it goes with if you just sort of put it in certain places in science class?
That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, Ron.
One of the thoughts I have on this is it seems to me that part of what the issue in our society is about is a resurgence of the importance of religious faith in our lives and for society. And that resurgence is over against a widely held belief, not just among scientists, but among political scientists, not just among mm-hmm. earth scientists, political scientists, analysts, etc., politicians, that religion was a factor of diminishing importance in life in this century. And I think it's religious faith is reasserting itself as an important factor. And one of the ways it gets reasserted is the whole issue of prayer in schools, the whole issue of teaching creationism in schools. Now, I think the problem with the argument sometimes is that all many of us have to say to that is no. Whereas I think what you just said is not just no, it's talking about where is the place of dealing with the issues that are dealt with in a religious understanding of creation. Where is the place for that in our schools? And I think there needs to be, I believe there needs to be a place for that in our schools, although in our society I feel very strongly it has to be done in a way that's open to different faith traditions. Understanding of that to maintain what I think is one of the very important values in our society, that is that religion is very important in our society, but our society will not make one religion the religion of the society or the religion of the school. So I think part of our problem with the argument is that if it just turns into a yes, creationism must be taught, no, it shouldn't be taught, I think we're maybe both sides of the argument are missing one of the important issues, which is how do you deal with basic religious questions in schools, and let things go? I mean, if you had a class on religion that dealt with these issues and you had science that dealt with these issues, then kids would have to be wrestling with these different understandings. And to me, that would be wonderful.
Pretty good point. Yeah,
Austin. I'd like to address that issue. For the last three decades in this state, I've been teaching that very thing. I think most people are under a misconception that it's illegal to deal with religion in schools. I happen to agree with the concept that it's illegal in a public school to advocate a particular faith. In my particular case, we teach world historical perspectives in which we deal with the six major faiths and how they affect the cultures of the people who believe in those faiths. It's all legal, and in fact, it's required. In many schools, and it's required in this state, but many schools ignore it. And I think probably you'd find it in many states that they do require by law that the cultures of other countries would be taught for the reasons as advocated by Ron. And if it were taught in that perspective, that we're trying to teach cultural understanding, all this humanities type stuff, then the very people who argue against religion in schools would find that they themselves would have to line up against it if we're going to have to utilize religion, say, to understand the Iranians or the Iraqis.
Sure.
Let me ask you, Leslie, how does that affect how the students process what they learn in science class? Do they come to wrestle with the two and put them in some sort of context together?
In my particular institution, in the science classes, evolution is being taught, and that's the proper place for it. And I agree with your remarks that we shouldn't be turning creationism into as if it's scientific fact. It is religious opinion, and therefore it should be in the social studies area. We can certainly discuss in the social studies the contrast between these two, as long as the teacher is not advocating.
Mm-hmm.
But you're merely saying that these are matters that you may want to consider for yourself, or you may choose to ignore them entirely. And occasionally in my classes, people have come up with the dilemmas or juxtaposition, as this gentleman mentioned. And for my own personal self, and I do share that with him, I say that a mind guard for myself is sometimes when I get so deeply immersed in these dilemmas and I cannot figure out how could this be if over here I believe this is true. I just get to a point where I fall back on the teaching which is in my personal faith of Christianity. And I've forgotten the location of it, but where we see through a glass darkly. And at some point, all will be clear.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And personally, I don't believe anybody knows. So you'll have to decide those things or decide not to think about it for yourself.
Yes?
Our society is very reluctant to accept the answer, I don't know, or the idea that something is a mystery. We're supposed mm-hmm. to figure everything out.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of some sort of compulsion we have that, you know, we have to tie up all loose ends. And I think that we need to relax a little and realize that it's going to be a long time before we understand even half of everything. So.
Well, that's very true. And as a scientist, I and my colleagues are often met with this expectation by the media, by the public at large, that, you know, we're supposed to know this stuff. Right, and take for example predicting volcanic eruptions.
Yeah.
That right now, that is more art than science, and yet the expectation is there that, you know, since we're professionals in this field, we ought to be able to do it. And if we don't, somehow we've screwed up somehow. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to go back to something that intrigues me that I mentioned a little bit at the beginning is that. You know, to me, science, and I'm sure there are theologians in the church that are probably, you know, have dialogues with science, you know, that those kind of projects go on around universities and seminaries, but that science in a certain way is, I think of it as ongoing revelation. And that, you know, if it is, and if we think of it that way, you know, what is it about breakthroughs in science or new ways of understanding, what do these reveal to us about the nature of God? And that's I feel like I'm on real thin ice there in terms of having thought a lot about this or read enough science to know this, but when I read a book like, you know, Brief History of Time or something, and you know, and I know Hawking is really an agnostic, I think is what he, I don't think he calls himself an atheist, but I think he sees himself as an agnostic. But I ask myself those questions, you know, what does this say to us about, you know, our ways of thinking about God? Is God a who, you know, or is God a what? You know, what about, you know, power in the universe and how we think about, you know, the power of creation and the power of God? And is there any, you know, overlap there? Acknowledging that the fundamental questions driving theology and science are different, but that still somehow there's this back and forth.
And it's the same reality.
Right, and it's the same reality, exactly. Yeah. It's like, yeah. Touching that elephant, you know, the blind people touching the elephant, you know, or the blind person touching the elephant, and, you know, you're touching the tail, and you think it's one thing, and the leg, and another thing. And but I would like to see more more opportunity in the church for us to learn from science and to be challenged by it, to think about God in some ways that aren't, you know, as confined as sometimes some of our old biblical images are. Not that they're not good, but that they're, we can stretch them out different ways, you know.
That's a really good point. And actually, as you were saying that, made me think, I wonder if this juxtaposition of this immense power that we see in nature and the universe and the creation of the cosmos and volcanoes and everything else like that, and if we try to understand God in that, that somehow is a threat to our understanding of God as the loving Savior, as a personal God who comes to us in gentle ways. And but I agree with you. It's really a challenge to try to put it all together.
We want it to be sort of understandable, but we want that the package, you know, we don't want to, you know, break it out of the package, sort of how we have carefully constructed our understandings.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, it's almost like a new reformation. I mean, that the church has gone through changes as, you know, human capacity for, you know, understanding things has changed, and I think in a way science presents that kind of challenge to the church in the modern era.
Mm-hmm.
It would be nice, in addition to having science challenge the church, to also have the church challenge the scientist, and maybe that's part of what we need to be about too, is to be less concerned with science and more concerned with the scientist.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I've spent a fair amount of time in school studying biology, particularly human biology, medicine. I think, like most people who spend time in school, the more you study, the more you know or realize that you don't know. And everything gets larger but yet smaller. Discovering atoms and, you know, quarks and all these subatomic particles, and I think God is in each one of these as well. And it's difficult to define, you know, where God's creation has stopped and where it started. And I think another question that maybe we're missing is that somehow we seem to deal with creation or with the beginning of the universe history. And it's not just history, it's ongoing. And maybe it kind of depends on what your belief is on whether God is an interventionist still, or whether he just got the clock started and he's kind of left it alone and he's sitting up on the mountaintop watching. But I think that he probably still has his hand in things. And it's still part of evolution. It's still part of creation. Creation hasn't stopped yet. And we're only this really small part of the whole spectrum of creation, from the beginning of the universe, the beginning of the earth, to human creation. And we don't know where it's going to stop. And there's, like some people have said, that there's questions out there that we'll probably never know the answers to until we die, and I think that's kind of the ultimate. You know, that's where you realize the answers to those questions that you always had.
Mm-hmm. I think you raise a really interesting point here too, and that's this dichotomy of God intervening in the earth, or in life on earth, in the way the world works, and and the world kind of ticking along as a clock, and God was simply the watchmaker that wound the spring and set it in motion. And we have to balance those two ideas, I guess. You know, I believe personally that very definitely that God intervenes, you know, on earth. Maybe the best example is with Jesus Christ and his coming into this world, but on the other hand, things happen by the laws of physics and biology and by the laws of nature that as we understand them, that seemingly go on without direct intervention from God. You know, clearly every time a puppy is born, that's not Immaculate Conception. There's, you know, the basic laws of biology are required there.
But yet those laws are too fantastic to just happen by random chance, or molecules coming together in some cosmic soup that just doesn't quite make sense. It's too fantastical. There has to be some intervening force there that's determining that. And if you believe that's God, I think that's probably right. And if you don't believe it's God, well, you're probably still believing it's God. You're just not putting that name on it.
In fact, when I was in graduate school, I was not a Christian, at least in the beginning. And one of the mysteries, I guess, that kind of pushed me in this direction was just exactly what you just alluded to, and that is the mystery of life and how it is that a bunch of these atoms somehow, when they get together in the right proportions, want to become life. And to me, that just boggles my mind. And that once it becomes life, that this life wants to reproduce itself again and again and again, even though we're talking about the simplest of organic creatures.
To say that slightly differently, I'm not sure what your name is. I've been calling you Joseph in my own mind because of your many colored jacket. But science teaches you that life reproduces life. But, you know, without some form of God, without some form of life giver or life carrier, you know, that a strictly materialistic view of the universe says that, you know, not only do frogs reproduce frogs, but rocks reproduce frogs or something similar, you know, and it becomes totally absurd. You know, and so, you know, it seems to me that at the very minimum, the furthest I can go is to say that a faith perspective makes at least as much sense as any other one. To me, it makes a good deal more. But
I guess something that makes that whole question a little more complex for me also is alluded to in Hawking's book, where he discusses the very improbable chance that that the chemicals of the universe would create life. But then he also covers that area in terms of what he calls anthropic principle, in which he basically says that if you imagine an infinite number of these universes evolving, and the fact that we happen to be in one where the random chances arose in creation, that's what he's basically saying. Is that the reason we see what we do is because if it didn't happen that way, we wouldn't be around to see it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a scientific counterpoint to that issue, but am I making any sense
in
that?
Sure. And that's part of the challenge, to try to comprehend.
Because on the one point, I appreciate the appearance that there is some kind of design to the evolution of life, but on the other hand, when somebody can come up with a scientific theory that says, but you know, if it wasn't that way, we wouldn't be around to observe it anyway. It's kind of like the law of large numbers and statistics. Outrageous things are still expected to happen.
Well, it doesn't seem to be most people's belief in God. That the idea that sort of you get to, as you look back and look for an explanation and say, well, there must be a God, that by itself doesn't really make for religious faith. There's something else which is more experiential that has to be a part of that. Because in a certain sense, if that's all you mean by belief in God, that you sort of make this argumentation, and you go back to Roman Greek times and find the argumentation sort of at the end, there must be a first cause, therefore that's God. In a certain sense, it's an argument. It's not a living relationship. It's like a, you've made a case for something, but then what do you have? You've sort of done it anyway. And it seems to me the other half of that, and probably more than a half, is our own sense of an experience of God. And that is a whole, that is another very complex and something that we, God knows, we dimly understand, but we have a sense that it's real. And that's, in a certain sense, not our finding God by argument, but God finding us. And that's at least as mysterious and complicated and both accessible to science. I mean, after all, psychology, psychotherapy, I mean, there's been a whole creationism and evolution aren't the only arguments in this. It's also psychotherapy and psychology and religious belief. And you have to look at all those, and they're real, and they do help explain. But maybe they, like evolution, don't say it all. Don't say enough. Don't.
And
maybe
fascinating as
well.
Yes,
this,
Bible, of course. Sure.
As fascinating as this subject is to make these comparisons and to debate, I believe Bishop Usher was totally wasting his time and on the wrong track. A scientist cannot offer me inner peace. And if I exercise my belief and have faith, I have inner peace. And to indulge in debate with a scientist regarding evolution or time frames, so what? we don't accomplish what we're here for, in my opinion. Yeah. Although I'd say it is fascinating, I agree.
But there has been that expectation of science, hasn't there? I mean, have drug therapy, inner peace. I mean, there has been, in a certain sense, science, there has been an expectation about science that in some way science, combination of psychology, neurobiology, chemical therapy, et cetera, that somehow we can, and God knows in mental institutions, people, you know, Gideon's wasn't given out half as much as all kinds of cups of drugs.
Yes.
Huh? What is a drug?
Prozac.
Yeah, all the Prozac.
I guess what I was meaning in the sense of inner peace is that, if there really isn't a God, and this is all just a belief that we've generated in order to control other people in some past and so forth, that, my God, I better get on with getting a lot of money then. And get my kicks while I'm around here. And if I'm a scientist that believes the other way, well then, when I know that this week probably that cancer is finally going to get me and I'm going to die. I got that secure knowledge that I'm just like the dogs. I'm going to be a dead dog in a week and that's the end of it. I see a lack of inner peace that at least can exist for me.
The joys of being here this summer, you rub elbows with theologians that give insight. Larry Rasmussen was here about 4 or 5 weeks ago, and he talked about the Bible being a combination of description and prescription. And the Bible is full of description, but for every description, God makes a prescription that addresses it. For example, in Genesis, it talks about the description of how the earth was created. But the prescription is that God created the earth good, and that's how God addresses the earth in an incarnational way. And so what happens so often is that we mix up description and prescription, and somehow we have to keep them in order as the way the Bible intended them to be. Mm-hmm. And that can go along not only with geological issues, but also social and ethical as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm.
We're just about out of time, and before we break, I did want to mention, make a kind of a recommendation for a book that I've been reading this summer, which I find fascinating, and it's one of these that really challenges me, and also challenges what's been the normal theory of evolution. This is a book, one of the newer books by Stephen Jay Gould. It's called Wonderful Life. And it's his description of a reinterpretation of the origin of life that is going on now within the science of paleontology and the interpretation of fossils and what those fossils are telling us about how life actually began on the Earth. And the short of it is that Darwin and most evolutionists who have followed him have viewed life as beginning very simply, and then the diversity and the complexity of life just expanding upward and outward from that simple beginning. And there were fossils found at the turn of the century, but only really interpreted, or actually reinterpreted, during the 70s and 80s, just the last few years, which pretty much turned that on its ear. And what these fossils are showing is that when the record of life first appeared in the rocks, it wasn't in that pattern of simple and then becoming progressively more diverse. What there was an explosion of diversity right from the very beginning. They're finding it in these rocks, in these shales, dating back to the early Cambrian times. And for example, they have described over 20 different basic body designs of arthropods. Arthropods are the simple animals such as insects and spiders and crustaceans and things like that. Insects, spiders, and crustaceans represent the three surviving body plans of the 20 or more that existed back in the very, very beginning of life on Earth. And all the rest disappeared. And a mystery to Gould that he's asking in the book is why. We don't understand, you know, what, because the fossils show that these life forms should have been and obviously were for millions of years capable of living and reproducing and carrying on and doing very well, thank you. But but he introduces the whole concept of contingency, and he seems to be coming from a fairly agnostic point of view here and doesn't make a very strong plug for God's hand in it all. And that that raises some interesting questions. Again, like Carol was saying there, this is new information. How do we deal with it? How do we fit God into this picture? I found it to be a fascinating book and has really given me something to think about.
Yeah. Just thinking about that in terms of Genesis, because this fits into how we're beginning our study document on the peace statement, but about this diversity of creation. I mean, that's the Genesis story. I mean, you know, the enormous diversity. That's the biblical story, really. And that there within that diversity, there was harmony, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's very, you know, that's sort of another chapter to your exercises a little bit before.
Yeah.
I was going to mention one other book, which I haven't read yet, but I've discussed with a couple other people, called Complexity, which also deals with the process of evolution. But now with the diversity, it basically comes out and deals with the fact that the complexity of the organs, such as the eyeball, or things like that, just simply cannot be explained in terms of natural selection for the amount of time that's been available for organisms to evolve. And so they're actually trying to create a new science called complexity, which is looking for other reasons, other forces that drive this kind of evolution, because they say just simple survival of the fittest just does not explain a lot of what we see.
Do you know who the author of the book is?
I'll think of it as soon as I go back to
the lodge. Yes.
Like another recommendation, about 10 years ago here, Walt Longren did an entire week on creation stories. And there's a tape in the library, I think it's from 83. And I think the title of the series is Stories Are the Arms of God.
What is the title?
Stories Are the Arms of God. He sees creation as a story, an ongoing story, that God spoke creation and he is still speaking it. And it's if you know his storytelling
It's a really, really nice introduction to the story of Genesis. He also does the Norse creation myth as well.
Well, thank you. Well, we have come to the end of our hour. I'd be happy to stay for a few minutes, and if you have any other questions you'd like to ask, I thank you very much for coming and joining in. And there are lots of mysteries, so let's be challenged by them and tackle them with enthusiasm. Thank you.